Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Trust the source. You were born to win, so be confident. Don't back down for nothing. Face the storm and trust the source. You were born to win.
It's just like
so be confident. Don't back down for nothing.
That little clip was Born to Win by High Hopes. Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. Every Monday from 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time to noon, my guests and I will bring you answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Today, we're going to be talking about a very important topic that touches the hearts of parents and professionals alike. Cutting. One of the most common self-harm behaviors, and it's on the rise among teens in American culture. Our guest today, Linda Mental, is a licensed marriage and family therapist and approved supervisor for the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. She is a diplomat in social work and an assistant professor of clinical pediatrics at Eastern Virginia Medical School. She appears regularly on several national television and radio shows and is a news consultant and contributor for CBN News. A national speaker and best-selling author with 16 book titles currently published, Dr. Linda is known for her humor and practical advice that will motivate you to positive life change. Dr. Linda, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Hi, Alan. It's great to be with you today.
Hey, it is great to have you. And I know that we spoke just a little bit. We will try to keep it light and airy so that it's not too warm for you there in Virginia Beach.
Yeah. I'm sitting with no air conditioning, which Californians don't understand because we have major humidity over here when it gets to the 100-degree mark.
Exactly. I have people that come out, and I live at the beach, and it's been hot, and they go, well, why don't you just turn on the air conditioning? And I go, we don't have it. And it just blows them away.
Right.
They go, how do you go through life? And go, well, it works for us.
Right. Well, I just figure that my skin will look good in years to come with all the humidity in the air. That's got to help me.
There you go.
So there's always an upside.
Absolutely. You know, I'm really glad to have you on. This is a subject that that I've had to deal with from the standpoint of picking up runaways. And we have, you know, we've picked some up. And unfortunately, you know, once they're out there, they're running away. I don't know if it's because depression sets in or something, but we've seen more and more of them now where by the time we're picking them up, they already have some of the scars. So I guess probably the best thing to do is, I mean, if you could just explain a little bit about what self-injury is and what it's not. And, I mean, for example, I know that some say it's suicidal behavior. What do you say it is?
Well, that actually is a common thought for most people because people really don't understand what self-injury means. And there's a lot of interchangeable terms. People will hear self-harm, self-mutilation, self-injury. It's all the same thing when they're talking about those three different words for it. But it is not suicidal behavior. People that self-injure do want to live. So it's not a death attempt. Now, sometimes it gets out of hand, and the way they cut, they might cut something that could result in their death. So there are times when self-injury does lead to death, but it's really not in the mind of the person to be killing themselves. It's not an addiction, and some people think it is, but there is really not the same type of addictive quality that we're talking about like we would with drugs and alcohol, although it can be very habitual, and after a while, it is a learned behavior that becomes habit, but people can make a choice to stop doing it. And then there are people who think that it's kind of like that there must be something wrong with the person. Maybe they're kind of disturbed or they're, you know, they're not really in their right mind. But again, this is done by teens who may be going to school, maybe a runaway, maybe someone who is just in your neighborhood that you would never suspect is struggling with a lot of inner distress and inner turmoil. And that's really what's going on. Behind all of that, self-injury is a way to cope. It's a dangerous way to cope and obviously a very destructive way of coping, but it's a way of coping with problems in relationships, with their life and feeling happy So it's really a cry for help is what it is.
Well, and that's just what I was going to ask, because I know that, you know, the question many of us in this industry get is, you know, why do teens do it? And that was going to be my question. Is it a cry for help? Is it more of a coping? You know, is it a follow the leader? I mean, what, you know.
Yeah, it's all of the above, actually, when you're saying all that. There really are three areas you can break self-harm into. And one is, there's so much struggle among so many teens to understand how to deal with their moods and their feelings and the intensity of relationships. And what we call in psychology, what we call affect regulation, which is just regulating your mood, regulating your frustration level and your anxiety and the stress of life. Self-injury is really one of those things that can help people regulate feelings, which sounds a little weird when you're talking about it, because you're thinking, okay, wait a minute, so you're feeling bad and you go and you cut yourself? Yeah, and actually what happens is that the person diverts the pain of whatever emotional feeling they have to a physical pain in the body and sort of zones out for the moment and focuses on that pain, and for a moment they're out of their other distress.
Wow.
And that's kind of weird sounding to people. They're like, really? But when you talk to cutters and people who self-injure, they'll tell you, yeah, when I'm cutting on my arm and I see the blood going down, I'm like totally feeling alive and connected to my body, which is something I was having trouble with before I cut. I know that sounds weird to people.
Wow, yeah, it does.
Right.
And you know,
but it also can be, let me give you the other two areas. It can also be a way to communicate and to say, you know, a lot of kids, when you start working with them, they don't know how to express the distress they're having in their lives. And so cutting is sort of an indirect way of expression for them. Just like, I mean, think about it. When people tattoo, they're indirectly expressing some kind of message or something on them, on their body, as a way of communicating. And self-injury can be the same thing. It's an indirect way of expression. And then the third big category of why people do it is that they do it for control. They feel like they're in control of their body when they're cutting versus all the other things that might be out of control, like being sexually abused, which there's a very high rate of that with cutters. Or they feel like they're sort of punishing themselves for bad things and the guilt and the shame of maybe behaviors and things that they've done.
Right.
So those three categories, to deal with their mood, to communicate indirectly, and to control and to punish their body.
Well, and you just mentioned in regards to sexual abuse being maybe one of the main risk factors that are associated with this. What are some of the other risk factors?
Well, we do see a high correlation with sexual abuse, and I've had a specialty practice for 20 years with eating disorders, and this is a very high risk also with an eating disorder, because of the underlying dynamics are very similar to the dynamics of injury. Also, somebody who might be diagnosed with what we call borderline personality disorder, which is a type of character disorder where the person has a lot of problems with impulse control, a lot of problems maintaining relationships, is very chaotic in their life in terms of decisions and you know, kind of high drama person. There's also a high correlation. People that come from families with a lot of depression or mood problems, anger, sexual abuse, major loss, trauma, those are all, you know, those are all things that are going to lead to possibly using self-injury as a way of coping with life.
Right. Now, when you say loss, I mean, is this more of just, you know, you lose your boyfriend or girlfriend, or is this where somebody's lost a loved one to death or divorce or all of the above?
Yeah, it can be all of the above. And again, it has a lot to do with sort of the personality structure of the person, because if you're somebody who has a very low tolerance for frustration, and you have a lot of stress in your life, the tipping point can be the boyfriend lost, and that can be the thing that sends you into some kind of cutting or burning or self-harm. So, you know, when we look at a person, we can't just say, oh, it takes divorce, or oh, it takes this major trauma like sexual abuse. It could be any kind of loss that could set it off based on other things that are going on. And I'm a family therapist, so I really am into looking at the family dynamics, and we know that with people who self-injure, that there's a lot of difficulty in those families of dealing with emotional issues and being direct in their communication and showing support and really dealing with issues when they come up. And so the family dynamics can play a role in this. And that's why families need to be treated in the process as well.
Right. Now, and I'm a very visual person, and which then goes, well, then why are you on radio? But anyway, as a visual person, what I'm seeing is, when you're talking about the stress level, is someone's carrying around a knapsack, and they've got this sack in the back, and whatever the stress is, they're taking it and they're putting it back there. And what you're saying is that it may be something, is, you know, like the loss of a boyfriend or a girlfriend, is the thing that they put in there, but that's the one that breaks the bag.
Right. It's sort of the tipping point for whatever else is going on in a person's life. And it really has to do with a teen knowing how to cope with those, you know, difficult feelings of, you know, you're in a stage of life where you're trying to figure out who you are, and you're trying to deal with your body, with sexuality and identity, and then negotiating your independence. And it's a tough time in life anyway. And then if you add to that some big stresses in your life, like relationship problems or family problems with divorce or a sexual abuse situation or date rape or something like that, any of those things can just really push the person over the edge.
Right. Now, is this type of cutting sort of a progressive thing?
It is. When we look at sort of how teens begin to do it, a lot of times they've seen somebody else do it, or they've heard of someone who's cutting. And now with all the media that's out there, you know, it's in storylines of television shows, and so they're familiar with what it means to be a self-injury person. If you just go on YouTube and you Google self-injury, you'll get all kinds of videos of teens who have made their own video about what it feels like when they cut themselves. So it's out there, and teens are very familiar with it. And then what happens is they might know about it, they might see somebody do it, they might try it. And then when they try it, they feel this a little bit of relief, and it kind of moves them away from the distress they're feeling to focusing on their body. And because of that relief then, they feel, oh, this is kind of helpful, but then they also feel a sense of guilt and shame because they're doing something that they know is harmful. And then the cycle kind of begins where they just continue to use that again as a way to cope with life. And eventually that can become a habit.
Well, yeah, and not a good one.
Right.
Now, I think as I had mentioned, I mean, we do a lot of work with runaways. And what I've seen over the last 30 years is an increase in self-mutilation scarring. Probably over about the last 10 years. Do you think there's a correlation between running away and self-harm? And if so, what?
Well, I'm not surprised to hear that, because there's an increase in self-cutting across the board anyway, and it just makes sense in that population. Years ago, I worked with a group called Safe House International, and we were working with girls that had been co-opted into prostitution and getting them off the street and giving them safe house, you know, a safe place to go. And a lot of those girls had self-injury issues going on. And if you think about it, I mean, just think about what we've been talking about, how, you know, sort of difficulty in the family, difficulty with relationships, not knowing your place, not knowing how to deal with stress and coping, the very things that sometimes cause kids to run away and to try to just escape life and go out. Maybe there's trauma at home. Maybe there's been sexual abuse by a parent, and they're running away to get away from the sexual abuse. Those are risk factors for cutting and self-injury, and so it just, to me, would make total sense for that population to have a very high rate of that. And the trick is to really help them understand that they're going to have intense feelings, but how you deal with those feelings is what they're going to need help with.
Right. And speaking of that, then, I mean, what can we do if we suspect someone is cutting? In other words, if we have a parent that's listening, or a professional, or even a sibling, you know, what can we do if we suspect that someone is, and not kind of push them away? Because I think one of the concerns is that if you jump right at them and you kind of attack them over it about how bad it is, and you cause them to run away, now they're further away from you, and you it's more difficult now to be able to get through to them.
Right. That's it's the same to me as when you go up to an anorexic and you tell her to start eating. Like, that's really not going to work too well. And it's the same thing with someone who's doing self-harming. Just to look at them and say, you need to stop doing that, just makes them feel even more worthless and more powerless than they were before. And those are the feelings that lead to the self-injury to begin with. So you don't want to just make some kind of judgmental comment to them or just tell them to stop, because that's not going to help them. But what you can do is begin to understand that self-harming behavior is really their attempt to maintain a certain amount of control in their life. And it's a way for them to self-soothe. And I think if we can, as weird as that sounds to a lot of people, if we can understand that they're trying to take control by cutting on their body and trying to move their pain off of their internal self onto their body, if we can understand that, then the understanding then would lead to us saying there are other ways to do that. So anybody who's aware that somebody might be cutting, to say, to really validate their pain and say, you must be feeling, you know, a lot of really difficult things inside. You must be really hurting at this time. And I know there are other ways to cope with that and other ways to deal with that. And there's help out there, ways for you to express the deep feelings that you're having, but not have to hurt yourself. And then, you know, try to get them to a therapist or into some kind of self-help group that could deal with this.
Now, are there any activities, specific activities that we could involve them in that maybe takes their mind away from that?
Well, it really is much more of the trying to help them not escape, but stay present in the moment. And that is really, when you're helping people do that, a lot of times you have to teach them how to relax and how to take a deep breath. I mean, when I work with people who've been sexually abused, they don't want to stay in the here and now, because then they're going to start feeling the pain of that sexual abuse. So before I ask them to really focus on the abuse, I've got to give them some techniques and some things that they can do to help them get through it and tolerate the feelings that they're going to have. And this is the same issue with people who have been harmers, is that you've got to help them learn how to do things like relax and to breathe deeply and to calm their body down, and then even to give them ways to calm themselves and soothe themselves. So, for instance, one of the things we do in inpatient settings with someone who's a cutter is, when they feel like cutting, we'll hand them a red marker and tell them to take the marker down their arm instead of a knife or a piece of glass. And they can see that. Or if they're trying to stay present and they don't want to escape the moment because it's so painful, we might have them stick their hand in a bowl of cold water to kind of shock them into the moment for a moment and say, okay, you're present. Do you feel that? You're feeling that. You're alive. It's okay. You can tolerate this. And a lot of the work in therapy is really giving them tools to learn how to tolerate distress and how to soothe themselves in ways that they're good and helpful, like you and I would. When I'm stressed, one of the things I do is go exercise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that helps calm me down. It's a much better way of soothing myself. Or maybe I'll take a relaxing bath, or maybe I'll put on some soft music, some calming music, or I'll, you know, sit quietly and meditate or pray. Those kinds of things need to be taught so that they don't feel like the only thing they can do to soothe themselves is to cut themselves.
Right. Well, what I hear you saying, and I like it, is that just trying to set up a diversion, in other words, another activity, is really only going to postpone them having to deal with it. What you're saying is go ahead and start helping them on how to soothe themselves and to get through it now, as opposed to, you know, because the thought that I was having is okay, you just try to get them involved in something else so that their focus is somewhere else. But again, it sounds like that's just postponing the inevitable.
Right, because they still have the inner pain that they're dealing with. It's like when I work with someone who is bulimic, who really wants to throw up after they've eaten. One of the things that we do in treatment is we bring in a meal, we have the person begin to eat the meal, and then they have that urge because of habit, because of, like what I'm saying with cutting, it becomes a habit, a way of coping with negative feelings. They'll start to feel like they're going to vomit. And I'll sit with them, and I'll have them take deep breaths. And I'll have them do some relaxation in their body, and we'll look at their thoughts and say, I can get through this. I can tolerate this. This distress is only for a moment. And the next thing you know, if they make it through 20 minutes with me helping them know how to relax and change their thoughts and to be present for that moment, in 20 minutes, the urge goes away, and suddenly they realize, wow, I can do this. Mm-hmm. I can cope. And that's what we have to do with people who teens who self-injure. We have to help them learn how to face the distress in their life, but do it in a way that they can tolerate it so that they can have a better life and a life that's worth living.
Absolutely. Let me go to some of the questions. One of the listener questions says, I have a 15-year-old daughter who has two scars on her arm that she claimed were accidents in art class. After talking to her teacher, mm-hmm. I now know that this is not the truth. What would you suggest I do before jumping in and confronting her about this?
Well, first of all, the parent is going through what most parents go through. I've treated a lot of teens with self-injury, and every time parents sort of suspect or they see, and listen, kids are really good at covering it up. They wear long sleeves. They wear long pants. They cut in their abdomen areas where it's not easily seen. In places that they can cut the inner thigh close up so that, you know, it's covered a lot easier. So first of all, don't get into a lot of guilt about that you didn't see this and you didn't know. But when you confront somebody about that, they will make an excuse. And that's one of the warning signs that parents need to be aware of, that they'll say things like, oh yeah, the cat scratched me, or I fell, or I hit the table. And there'll be frequent complaints of accidental injury. So that's a good warning sign for that parent to realize. But the best thing is to sit down and say, look, I know I've read a little bit about this. I'm wondering if you're having difficulty in your life, and this is a way that you're using to cope. And I know that things must be difficult for you right now. I want to help. Can we go and get some help for this? Because this is not the way, that you want to deal with life. Now, the teen will probably not be thrilled.
Right,
because,
right.
Again, I've had a lot of parents bring in their kids to me for therapy, and the teen is, you know, angry and mad that their parent found it out, and probably more determined than ever to do it. But if they can build a good relationship with their therapist and begin to talk about the pain, they're gonna do better. So, in the same way it is with any kind of abuse or an eating disorder, when you confront somebody with love and with their concern in mind, don't expect them to go, oh, thank you.
Right.
You know, I want to help. Expect to get a little bit of denial and resistance, but you still have to, as a parent, say, you know, this is something we got to get a handle on, and I really want you to learn how to cope better with things, so we're going to go get some help.
Well,
and then I would offer as a parent to go in as a family.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's a great idea. But what are some of the avenues of help that are available to them? In other words, obviously one is to go to someone's private practice that specializes in this.
Right.
But, you know, if you have resistance to that, are we then looking at possible residential treatment? And then the other question in this economy is, what about the people that just can't afford it?
Right. Right. So there are community mental health centers in every community. There are places in those community mental health centers where you can get pay-as-you-go, maybe a dollar a session, or even free sometimes, depending on your social, you know, your economic status. So there always is help in a community. And you may not find someone who specializes exactly in self-injury, but someone who understands teens and coping and the issues of teenagers. And that would be a good place to look, is to ask someone who specializes, first of all, in self-injury, if there is such a person, or then someone who understands teenage issues and the amount of stress and how they deal with issues and identity and sexuality and all the things involved in that. It's very hard to get people into an inpatient setting, to be honest with you, Alan,
okay.
With self-injury, as it is with an eating disorder, because the criteria for getting people into inpatient settings is always, are you a harm to yourself? In terms of suicidal, homicidal, or psychotic. And we're saying that this is none of the above.
Mm-hmm.
But this really isn't a suicidal behavior. It's a cry for help in terms of, I'm in pain, please help me deal with my pain differently. So that's the frustration, is it doesn't really merit what is considered in mental health today, the hospitalization status. But there are outpatient programs, there are day treatment programs, there are groups. There's a wonderful type of therapy called dialectical behavior therapy. It's known to the consumer as DBT. And it has a lot of groups that meet. And you can sometimes find these groups in a community. And what they do is they work on issues in those groups, such as, how do I tolerate distress? When I feel like I want to hurt myself, what can I do instead? And they're very specific to the kinds of issues that somebody could use. So maybe finding a group therapy, getting into a self-help group. I know on the internet there's a 1-800 don't cut, mm-hmm. and also a website I think called Safe Alternatives, which and then there's even a selfinjury.com. So there's a lot of help, and those places also will lead people to other kinds of online help. And one of the kind of cool things we're finding out about online help in a lot of the areas of mental health is that building those communities online, because teenagers are so used to that, can actually be helpful and supportive and can actually do some good in their lives. So that's a good resource.
Well, yeah, and right now it falls right into their social networking
right.
way of life, so that part
right.
kind of fits. But it would also seem like much of the issues are things that really need to be done in person. For instance,
right.
how much of the time would you spend if you get somebody in there and you realize that the underlying problem is depression? I mean, that's certainly not something you can work on over the internet. So.
Right, right. I mean, I really think in order to break the habit or to really get at the root of why the person feels the need to cut and harm themselves, they're going to have to go to a therapist. That just, to me, a therapist understands how to connect the dots for the person and to say, oh, look, this is tied to this, and that's why you're doing it. I mean, this is what I would do with teenagers. I would say, so when you feel this, then you begin to cut. Okay, can we back up the sequence? When you're going to feel this, you're going to have this rejection at times from a guy, or you're going to, you know, get a horrible grade on a test, or you're going to have the stress of some other girl talking bad about you behind your back. When you feel that feeling, let's come up with another thing or two that you can do rather than harm your body. And you work with them, and you build in some other behaviors, and then you sort of role play those behaviors, and you anticipate what's going to happen, and you really have to work with the therapist so that you can identify what are those cues or those triggers that bring on that feeling. How can I change that? And in a lot of cases, you have to do family work, because the family has to get more tuned in to the emotional issues that are going on. The family has to be more willing to confront things when they come up. They have to get their communication more direct. And that usually takes the help of a family therapist.
Well, that makes sense. We are talking with Dr. Linda Mental. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, I'd like to know a little more about one of your books, Getting Unstuck. We'll be right back.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
Trust the source. You were born to win, so be confident.
That's right, we're all born to win. So, Dr. Linda, tell us a little bit more about Getting Unstuck.
Well, this was actually one of the first books that I've written. I've actually written 16, and I'm working on my 17th now. And so I'm becoming quite the book writer, which I never thought was something I would ever do. So that's been kind of a fun little thing for me to do. But when I was doing full-time practice and working in hospitals and inpatient settings and all of that, I just began to think about what were the top three issues for most women. Because I do see a lot of men, too, but I was seeing a lot of women and a lot of teenagers. And I started thinking about, it seems like so much of our problems in dealing with life seem to fall into three areas, and they're all related to loss. And so the first area is a loss of a relationship, whether it's by divorce or by death or by a breakup you know, or a friend betrayal or whatever it is. But that's a major category for most people. When they experience a loss in their relationship, it can set us off into a negative cycle of mental health. And then the second loss that a lot of us experience at different times in our life are the loss of situations or health, like losing a job, finding out that you have breast cancer, you know, having, I'm listening to all these, you know, people in the Gulf Coast now who are dealing with the loss of their economy with the oil spill and what that's going to mean for their economy, or during Katrina, the loss of your family home and even the loss of lives there, but situational loss where something negative has happened and we're experiencing a loss. And then the third area that seems to affect all of us is the loss of expectations, where maybe you're 40 years old and you were thinking you were going to be somewhere in your career and you're not. Or maybe you're a single person and you're thinking, boy, I really thought by this time in life I'd be married or I would have children. Mm-hmm. So I started to think about what really gets us into trouble in terms of anxiety, depression, and eating disorders. It's all related to these three areas of loss in our life. And that really was the theme of the book, was how to deal with loss when it comes to loss of relationships, the loss of some kind of situation or your health, and then the loss of expectation.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that after that, it's just how we choose to deal with it. We're saying some people end up with an eating disorder, some people start cutting, some people drink, some people do drugs, but people are responding to that particular loss or whatever it is that came into their life.
Right, because we all have that. If you think about it on a daily basis, something doesn't happen the way we want it to happen. Something disappoints us. And I'm not trying to be like real pessimistic about life here, but life doesn't always go the way that we want it to. And what I see is that instead of being able to face that, to deal with that, to say, okay, and to grieve it, to actually grieve it, and move on. I was very influenced by a psychotherapist years ago named Norman Paul, who was actually, I think he was one of the survivors of the Holocaust, and he was very moved in his theory about mental health in terms of how loss impacts all of our life. And in my own life, I had to deal with a brother who was killed years ago from a bomb on an airplane from terrorists before we ever even heard of terrorists. Mm. I went through 7 years of infertility before I actually was able to have children. And there, I was starting to think that, you know, it's the way you grieve those issues or the way you deal with things when they come up in your life and they're not exactly what you want that really makes a difference in whether you're going to get stuck in you know, in what you were just saying. You're going to cut yourself, you're going to be anxious, right. You're going to be depressed, you're going to, you know, drink or whatever you're going to do, or you're going to deal with that issue and then move forward in life.
Well, let's talk about some of the ways in which we can deal with some of these things, because we're certainly at a time, you know, in our lives right now to where there is a lot of things going on around the world. So what are some coping skills that people can take away from listening to this?
I think the number one thing, Alan, is to always have some kind of hope in the back of your mind that, you know, it's bad this moment, but it's not always going to be bad. And if you can just tolerate the distress of whatever is going on in your life right now and get through that distress and manage those feelings and put them in the proper perspective by looking at your thoughts and keeping your thoughts positive that, hey, maybe I don't have a job today, but tomorrow's another day and I'm doing what I can do and focusing on the future as well as the present, that really goes a long way. That's the whole field now of positive psychology, which is really helping us understand that if we focus on the glass half full, that you know, that we still can move forward in life. And yes, bad things happen and negative things happen to us, and we are constantly grieving things that we maybe didn't want to happen in our life, but that we learn from those things and we grow from those issues and we can move forward. If I had never had a brother who would have been killed, I probably would be a lawyer somewhere in a corporation, because that's where I was headed before that happened. So a terrible circumstance in my life led me into a very different field that has been very gratifying and very fulfilling for me in terms of helping other people.
All right. Now, what can we tell people to do or share with people from the standpoint of at what point are we enabling versus we're helping. You know, so when you have somebody, that person that loses the job, okay, now we're going to try to help them. So let's say that we're, you know, we're introducing them to people in regards to getting a job or whatever. In other words, at what point are we doing so much for them that now they're just not doing it themselves?
That's a great question, because it really does boil down to this issue of how can you gently confront people and help them move forward without taking over. Mm-hmm. And that is a fine line for parents, for bosses, for all kinds of people. When you think about it, it's really the issue of a parenting. I've got two teenagers. That's always my issue. How can I gently confront them? Point out what they, what's not, you know, what they're not doing right at the moment that they need to be doing or moving forward, or if there's a problem, like self-injury, if you notice that something's going on, how do you gently confront that issue, but stay positive with the person and move them forward? And I think a certain amount of confrontation is always needed in healthy, intimate relationships. And I'm a little worried about a lack of doing that. Here's what I hear the 20-year-old saying all the time is, don't judge me, don't judge me.
Right. Right.
And I'm sort of like, I'm not judging you, but I'm discerning that there's an issue here that really needs to be confronted.
Exactly.
So we've got this kind of weird thinking about we can never tell anybody that what they're doing is maybe a problem or is creating problems for other people or for people around them or for themselves. And that's kind of crazy.
Well, I
know. When you think about intimacy.
Right. Well, and you bring up a great point, because we have a lot of things now to where people will go, well, that's just my way. You know,
right. And, you know, yeah, but your way is not working for you.
Exactly.
You know, I hate to be the cliche of Dr. Phil, but is it working for you? It's kind of a good question.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and your behavior has consequences. And so this idea of confrontation, do it in a nice way, do it in a loving way. But let's begin to say, you know, my daughter had this conversation with me the other day. She was talking about a kid who she knows who smokes, and she said, you know, it's just so bad for him. And why is he making that decision? I said, well, have you said that exact same thing to him? She goes, well, no, you know, why it's, you know, that if that's what he wants to do. I said, Katie, a good friend would go up to somebody and say, look, I don't know why you're smoking. I just know it's going to be harmful to your body. It's not really that cool of a thing to do. It's illegal. You know, as your friend, can we just do something? Can you do something else that wouldn't be harmful? I don't want to watch you die or get a disease.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that kind of teaching and training of how to go to somebody and say, I care about you, but I notice what you're doing. I'm getting scared, Alan, that we're losing this ability to do this because of all this, you know, tolerance in our culture and don't judge me and never confront anybody. And if it works for them, then it doesn't matter. But, you know, we live in community and we live with each other. And to me, loving and caring people confront issues when they come up. And that's what moves a relationship into deeper intimacy.
Right. And I think you brought up a great point about somebody believing that you're trying to control them. I mean,
and
I think that's, and I run into that myself, to where it's, you know, okay, well, how about doing this or this instead of this, you know, because this is bad for you, you know, well, you don't control me. You know, well,
no, but I'm here as a person who cares,
who
about,
cares
you
about
to
you.
Show
right.
you that if you go down this path, it's going to take you here. And here's another path that could give you a great outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And that's more of what we have to do with people, is help them sort of problem solve. I think one of the fallouts, if I can call it a fallout, of sort of all the technology that we have, is we're losing this face-to-face contact with people where we actually have these kinds of conversations.
Absolutely.
And we need to bring those back. And you know where you start? You start in your own families to do that, where you put down the cell phones, you don't text each other across the house. You get to each other at the dinner table, which is, again, a lost art, have dinner together, actually talk, and talk about how things are going and how we're getting, you know, how we're getting along.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me jump to another question. We've got another question that was emailed in, and it says, a friend who is a junior high school teacher recently told me that in the last 3 years, there's been a dramatic increase among her students ages 12 to 13 years old who are cutting themselves. She thinks this is more risk-taking than pain relief, much like smoking or having sex. Please tell us what you think about this situation with the tween age group.
Well, the tween age group is where the onset of this really begins, between the ages of 10 to 16. So that is the point where people begin to do this. There is an element of what the emailer is talking about, of this sort of contagion I want to call it, I guess, group contagion, where somebody starts cutting and other people start doing it. But the kids where it sticks and they actually use it, there's a whole bunch of biological research involved in this, and it gets real complicated, so I don't want to, like, you know, make people fall asleep while they're listening to you. But it really, there are certain people where it does release a sort of euphoric high in the brain. And almost like the same thing that we would see with a drug addict, you know, where some people can take that first drink and become an alcoholic, mm-hmm. and other people can take a drink and it doesn't have that same kind of impact because of the difference in their chemistry.
Right.
This is also true with cutters, that there are some people that get that sort of euphoria when they cut, and it becomes almost like a physical addiction. It's not, but it has that same kind of brain power. And so there are kids who will experiment and just try it to be cool and think it's no big deal, but the kids who continue to do it are the kids who are in some kind of turmoil and distress, and this is actually working for them as a way of reducing pain or communicating or, you know, dealing with their mood. So it is more prevalent in that age group to begin with. And you know, maybe one of the things we really need to start doing in middle schools and high schools is providing some, you know, education to the kids about this is what this is. And if you have a friend, they really need help, and you really do need to say something to someone and get them into therapy, and so that they don't use this as a way to deal with their life issues. And maybe working with parent groups on the same thing would be a good idea.
And I think that's excellent advice. And I know we have some teachers and school officials that listen because they've emailed in, and I hope they take that to heart. Now, I was a room dad in the early years, so I don't know if they're discussing this in middle school or not, but it sounds like it would be a great thing.
They need to be, and I tell you what, I just did a conference for teachers, and I was on the docket to talk about self-injury and to help them understand what it's all about, what are the risks, you know, the warning signs, what are the risk factors, and trying to get them educated. So I know at least school districts, at least in our state, are paying attention because of the rising numbers of kids who are engaging in this. And because media kind of glorifies it, makes it look like it's something kind of cool.
Yeah.
You know, so you can see it in the storylines of TV shows and things, and I'm not so sure they always do a good job of dealing with the consequences of things when they happened.
Yeah, I think we could do a whole nother show on that and my feeling on some of the ways in which things are portrayed on TV.
Right.
I've got another question. It is,
okay.
This also came in via email, and I thank those that are sending these in. It says, I was not aware of this problem until last year. I was shocked at the number of teens I read about on the web doing this. I would like to know, what is the extent of the scarring and infection risks to teen cutters? Also, what parts of the body are teens cutting themselves on?
Well, I mentioned some of the parts, that it's typically the inner thigh, the upper thighs, sometimes the shoulders, near the shoulders, because if you can cut in an area that you can cover it up with a long sleeve shirt or pants or a skirt, that's the easiest way. The abdomen is another favorite place, because typically parents don't see abdomens, or they don't see them unless they're wearing a bathing suit. And that's another warning sign, is if you see a teen who's going to the beach or some place where they typically are at a pool or something, and they're not willing to put their bathing suit on, that may be why, or they're suddenly wearing a one-piece and they never used to wear a one-piece. That's a good indication. The other thing I do want to let people know is that the ways, you know, that it's cutting is the most common, and they scratch with sharp objects, whether it's a razor or a piece of glass. There's also branding that happens where they're burning themselves with a hot object, mm-hmm. or some kind of friction. Like, kids will sit in classes in the school, and they'll take a pencil eraser, and they'll rub it into their skin and burn it into their skin. Mm-hmm. And then picking at a wound is another form of self-injury, and reopening the wound. And when the person emailing was asking about, you know, scarring, if you're constantly picking at a wound and opening it up and digging into it, that will leave a scar eventually. And there are some of these kids who have to go in for some repair because of the damage they've done to their skin. Hair pulling is another one. Hitting themselves. I've worked with kids who just hit themselves with an object until they're bruising. And then there's some controversy about whether multiple piercing and tattooing is a form of self-injury, and when that takes on sort of an addictive quality, maybe it's getting into that. And then the newest one that just blew me away was this self-embedding, where teenagers will take an object and they'll embed it into their skin, under their skin, like a piece of metal or piece of wood or something. And that a lot of times takes a surgical removal to get that item out.
Mm. Yeah, and we've seen some of those as well. And in one case, it was a piece of bone that was not human bone, but they wanted a particular look. They wanted it to look like a bump. And so,
wow.
So they literally put a piece of bone under the skin.
Under the skin. Yeah, and I've had, I work in a pediatric hospital where the surgeons have had to get involved in removing some of those self-embedding things, so it can become dangerous because of the potential for infection.
Oh, yeah.
An infection in terms of, not being clean and not using, all the right equipment. And, of course, I don't think that's something anybody wants to do anyway. But, again, the pain of doing that is where the high comes into.
Yeah, now you mentioned a little bit about the tattooing. What about from an infection standpoint with that? I mean, would that be something that a cutter is doing that is kind of a way to hide it?
Yes, and that's, again, the concern is that, it's a fine line. We've had a lot of discussions in the professional world of is a teen who's doing multiple piercing and multiple tattooing really moving into a self-injury point of view? And I think you really have to know the dynamics of the teen in terms of, the bigger picture of their whole personality and what's going on at home and what's going on in their own individual, mind to really know whether that's that kind of form. But, we have at the Children's Hospital, we have guidelines for parents in terms of the damage that multiple piercings can do to the body, and if things are not done in a clean way, of course, that's a very big concern. These kids are not thinking about getting hepatitis C or something serious. And what's really interesting, when you get a physician to talk about where you pierce, the physician will tell you that one of the safest places is in the earlobe. And when you start piercing in other places, you're damaging parts of the body that risk interfering with circulation and parts of the body. We know the tongue, there's all kinds of issues with infection and even speech impediments and growth on the tongue. So it gets really interesting. But the physicians have great articles out there on what to look out for and what to be concerned about.
Well, yes, and to add one to that, because we worked with a child that we had to take from a program to a hospital for surgery because they've had nerve damage because of the piercings
right.
in their tongue. So
right.
it was causing facial nerve damage, and they were losing part of the movement in their face.
Right.
So I mean,
and that can happen in the nose and other places of the body, too, because of the potential for nerve damage and the lack of circulation. So there's a lot of concerns there that we need to be talking to kids about.
Well, and I appreciate you talking about it, not only on the air, but also in your books. And again, I just want to tell everybody, if you want to get in touch with us, you want to get in touch with any of our guests, you can contact us at www.answersforthefamilyblog.com. And in specifically, if you want to reach Dr. Linda for more help or information, you can visit her website at www.drlindahelps.com. In addition, you can submit questions for either upcoming guests or topics, suggestions, anything either for the show or directly for Dr. Linda. Thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, Alan,
this
I'm so glad that you're bringing awareness to issues like this for families, because there's just so much going out there and parents feel a little overwhelmed. And I really believe shows like yours is a way to help them sort of make sense of all the things that teens and families are dealing with today. And we need as much of that as possible to help each other. So thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. And just let's close on, what is book 17 going to be about?
I'm dealing with worry this time, so the title is Say Goodbye to Worry and Don't Invite It Back.
Okay, and speaking of biting back, let's have you back when you're ready to launch that one.
Sounds great. I'd love to do it.
All right. Thank you. Bye
Thanks
now.
For having me.
Bye. Until next week, seek to catch someone doing something good every day.
Listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza.
Alan Cardoza.
Only on LA Talk Radio.